This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Imagine an America in which the economy has collapsed and people are divided into two classes, low net worth individuals and high net worth individuals. There's only one political party, but parts of the country are on the verge of civil war or class war. The news media is dominated by the New York Lifestyle Times, Fox Liberty Prime, and Fox Liberty Ultra. Most of the news is journalists texting about themselves. This is the America that Gary Steingart has created in his new novel, Super Sad True Love Story, which is set in the very near future. In novelist Jane Smiley's review of the book, she wrote, "It's as amusing and harrowing a reflection upon the world we live in now and the direction we could be heading as you can hope to find." Steingart, who is 38, was one of the writers featured this year in the New Yorker edition featuring the 20 best writers under 40. Steingart was born in Leningrad in 1972 and moved to the U.S. with his parents when he was 7. He's written two other satirical novels, The Russian Debutante's Handbook and Absurdistan. Gary Steingart, welcome back to Fresh Air.
So, thank you. It's so great to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. I'd like you to start with a reading that will give us a sense of the satirical notes that you that you strike in the book. So we've agreed on what the reading will be, so I'll ask you to just set it up briefly for us.
Sure. Well, Terry, what's happening here is Lenny Abramov, who is the hero of my book, is about to return from a year in Rome. He's about to return to America. But you can't just return to America anymore. You have to actually go through this process of reentry. And the program is called Welcome Back, Partner. And it takes place at embassies across the world. So this is at the U.S. Embassy in Rome, or the U.S. Consulate, I should say. And one more thing about it, like all citizens and all people in America, he wears a pendant around his neck called an apparat. And what the apparat does is it basically controls everything in your life. It also ranks you. So when you enter a room, people can say, oh, he's the 18th ugliest man in the room, but he's the 7th richest man in the room. So it also rates your personality. And Lenny's personality is very sparkling, but he's very unattractive. So his apparat is the device that he uses in this scene to communicate with the government. A half dozen of my fellow citizens were seated behind their chewed-up desks, mumbling lowly into their apparati. There was an earplug lying slug dead on an empty chair and a sign reading, "Insert earplug in ear. Place your apparat on desk and disable all security settings." I did as I was told. An electronic version of John Cougar Mellencamp's Pink Houses. "Ain't that America? Something to see, baby," twanged in my ear, and then a pixelated version of the plucky otter shuffled onto my apparat screen, carrying on his back the letters ARA, which dissolved into the shimmering legend, American Restoration Authority. The otter stood up on his hind legs and made a show of dusting himself off. "Hi there, partner," he said, his electronic voice dripping with adorable carnivalesque. "My name is Jeffrey Otter, and I bet we're going to be friends." Feelings of loss and aloneness overwhelmed me. "Hi," I said. "Hi, Jeffrey." "Hi there yourself," the otter said. "Now, I'm going to ask you some friendly questions, for statistical purposes only. If you don't want to answer a question, just say, 'I don't want to answer his question.' Remember, I'm here to help you. Okay, then, let's start simple. What's your name and social security number?" I looked around. People were urgently whispering things to their otters. "Leonard or Lenny Abramov," I muttered, followed by my social security. "Hi, Leonard or Lenny Abramov, 205-328-7-14. On behalf of the American Restoration Authority, I would love to welcome you back to the new United States of America. Look out, world. There's no stopping us now." A bar from the McFadden and Whitehead disco hit, "Ain't No Stopping Us Now," played loudly in my ear. "Now tell me, Lenny, what made you leave our country? Work or pleasure?" "Work," I said. "And what do you do, Leonard or Lenny Abramov?" "Indefinite life extension?" "You said effeminate life invention, is that right?" "Indefinite life extension," I said. "What's your credit ranking, Leonard or Lenny, out of a total score of 1600? 1520. "That's pretty neat. You must really know how to pinch those pennies. You have money in the bank. You work in effeminate life invention. Now, I just have to ask, are you a member of the bipartisan party? And if so, would you like to receive our new weekly apparat stream, Ain't No Stopping Us Now? It's got all sorts of great tips on readjusting to life in these United States and getting the most bang for your buck." "I'm not a bipartisan," I said, "but yes, I would like to get your stream." I was trying to be conciliatory. "Okie dokie, you're on our list now."
That's Gary Steingart reading from his new novel, Super Sad True Love Story. Gary, so you have some very funny satirical things going on here that are kind of alarmingly close to the present.
So. Yes, alarmingly, I would say. Yeah. You got that right, Terry.
So let's start with what's going on politically here. The reading had a reference to the bipartisan party. What's the bipartisan party?
There's only one party left at this point in America, and it's the bipartisan party. And it's really nice because we don't have to choose between Republicans and Democrats, which were different, but, you know, they had some commonalities. So it's much nicer and more streamlined to have one party, the bipartisan party. The bipartisan party runs something called the American Restoration Authority, which is basically a bunch of very armed National Guards people running around trying to save the infrastructure, which is collapsing as we speak. The Williamsburg Bridge goes down during one point in the book. And everything is basically slowly falling apart.
There are great political divisions in the country. There's even an insurrection that happens in the book. What are the divisions about?
Well, the divisions are about whatever happens when a country begins to slowly begin its descent, especially when it's a major country. You know, I grew up in the Soviet Union, and then we came to a Hebrew school in Queens. So I know about dystopia. I know about things that don't work. I know when things begin to fall apart, especially when a country is as big as America or Russia, a country that has a kind of messianic belief in itself, that we are not just important, but we are the most important country in the world. And for countries like that, a decline is never pretty because the landing is never as soft.
Why did you want to write a book set in the future so that you could do something satirical?
There's no present left. This is the problem for a novelist, is the present is gone. We're all living in the future constantly. How I envy...
Wait, what do you mean by that? I'm not sure what that means.
Well, look, back in the day, Leo Tolstoy, what a sweetheart of a count and a writer. He wanted, in 1860s, he wanted to write about the Napoleonic campaign about 1812. If you write about 1812, you know, in 1860, a horse is still a horse and a carriage is still a carriage. Obviously, there have been some technological advancements, etc. But, you know, you don't have to worry about explaining the next killer app or the next, you know, Facebook or whatever, because right now things are happening so quickly. I think that's really at the heart of this novel, because this is the first time I've written a love story. And I actually began to feel something for my characters. I love Lenny and Eunice, and they're from different planets, basically, because even though there's a 15-year difference between them, they're basically standing on opposite cliffs with this huge abyss between them, because Lenny still belongs to the ruminative generation, the generation that reads, that tries to understand its place in the world. And Eunice, who is much younger, now lives, she's a very, very smart young girl, but she lives in a whole different world where the only thing that matter are things that happen instantly. They pop out at you, and then they're forgotten, and we move on to the next thing.
And she doesn't even know how to read books. She knows how to skim texts for information.
Right. There was something called Eurotexts in her. She went to Elderberg College. It's a small women's school in the book, where she was taught to scan texts. So you can just get all the information you need very quickly and then just throw the book away. This actually is not science fiction. I think this is what is happening on college campuses now. But she majored in images and she has a minor in assertiveness. So those are very important things to have in the future.
Do you feel like Lenny, like somebody who is an artifact of the past because you read books and even more artifactful, you write books.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm it's so depressing. I feel like I'm insane to write novels. I'm like one of those, you know, those last Japanese soldiers on one of those islands who's like hiding in a cave and still shooting at the Americans are advancing and he still hasn't heard that the emperor has surrendered. Yeah, that's what I feel like all the time.
So
I'm one of those guys.
What about like your texting life and your smartphone life? Like how distracting has or informative and useful has that been for you? And do you find that your concentration span as a writer or a reader is being changed?
It's over. My concentration, my reading life, it's been shot. I mean, this is one of those cases where I'm not against technology. I love my iPhone passionately. I think it's a beautiful piece of technology. But sometimes technology outpaces sort of the humanity's ability to process it. You know, I think that's where we are right now. I know that's where I am right now because my mind has been sliced and diced in so many ways. There's so many packets of information coming at me, especially in a city like New York, which is so dense with information, no matter where you go. I mean, even our cabs have television screens and info centers built into the back seat. You know, and it's just shocking how is literature supposed to survive when our brain has been pummeled with information, sliced and diced with it all day long at work if we're white-collar workers? We go home. Are we really going to open up a thick text with 350 pages and try to waddle through it? Or are we just going to turn on Mad Men, which is a wonderful show, for example?
It's a great show.
It's a great show. But see, what Mad Men does, which is so wonderful about it, is it takes a lot of the things that make novels great. It takes so much of that novelistic precision, and also it takes time to explain its characters, to develop its characters, and also to try to get into the minds of its characters as far as film will allow. So it satisfies all our narrative impulses. That's what we want. But we don't have to open a book to get it. We just watch it on the screen. The Sopranos, The Wire, Mad Men, all these shows very cleverly are indebted to novels. And all the creators of these shows frequently talk about how they're indebted to novels. I just don't want novels to die because that's what I do.
Well, that's what you're, it sounds like that's what you're trying to do because you say you lost your concentration. So where are you now as a writer and a reader?
As a reader, I go upstate to New York, upstate, and there, because I have this iTelephone, it can't connect well up there. And all of a sudden, my mind begins to readjust, and I fall into this idyllic state. And all of a sudden, books make sense to me again. I'm so used to the iPhone that sometimes I'm like pressing on the cover of the books, waiting for some piece of information to fly up. You know, my friend bought me this beautiful photograph, and one of the pictures in the photograph it was a bunch of people sitting at a table, and one of the faces was too small, and I started to try to spread it open like you could on an iPhone to make it bigger, and then I realized, oh wait, it's just a photograph; it's not digital.
Okay, so Lenny, the main character in your book, he's working on a life extension program, and he decides in the very first sentence of the book that he's going to live forever, or as close to forever as he can through this scientific life extension program. And he says that he believes that any life ending in death is essentially pointless. Is that something that you've dealt with?
Yes. A good friend of mine turned 50 recently. He said, oh, my God, Gary, I can see that life is not eternal. And I thought, you just figured this out now, you know, because death has been on my mind since I was a little pup. You know, I was very, very sick when I was growing up in Russia. The ambulance constantly came to our house. I had a horrible asthma that, you know, is easily treated in America, but they didn't even have inhalers back in Russia. So what I remember the most is just constantly being in that ambulance, trying to breathe, can't breathe. And even as a little child, you're thinking, this means I'm going to die. And what's going to happen after I die? You know, and in Russia, growing up in Soviet Russia, there's not even the consolation of heaven. Maybe you become a great red pioneer in the sky or something, but there's not a consolation of that. So, you know, I always think that a good writer should be growing up on the brink of death. It really sort of lets them see mortality very clearly. All my characters think about death in one way or another, all my previous characters in previous books. But with Lenny, what really is terrible for Lenny is that he works at this place called Post-Human Services, which caters to the very rich. And it's one thing to die in a world where everyone will eventually die. But to work with people who won't die and to know that you yourself are slated for mortality, that is too much for Lenny to even begin to contemplate. So he sinks a lot of his mortality wishes into his girlfriend, Eunice Park, who is as lively and young as anybody in his world. And he begins to displace a lot of his own feelings, his own dreams of mortality onto her, which, of course, in the end does not work.
Did you go through the death of any family or friends while you were writing this book?
Not when I was writing this book, but my grandmother, you know, when we came to America and I was surrounded by completely insane people in all levels of life, this awful Hebrew school, my parents dealing with the horrors of immigration. And there was one woman, my grandmother, who was unbelievable. She whenever the school bus would pull up from Hebrew school, I was already 13 years old, she would run out and she was so afraid. You know, America's a very dangerous country, Queens especially. She would run up, grab my hand, and just slowly we would walk to make sure, you know, she was like a little terrier looking out to make sure nobody would jump us. This is Forest Hills, Queens. And we would walk back to her apartment, and then she would say, oh, lie down, Igorochuk. Igor is my Russian name. Gary is some kind of stupid American invention. So she would make me lie down on the couch, and in this kind of almost Caligula-like position, she would come bearing trays and trays of food. There would be several pizzas and several hamburgers and, you know, and I became so fat that for my bar mitzvah, I had to wear a specially made husky suit made out of, you know, four other bar mitzvah suits. But when she died, I lost this beautiful, tender connection that I think I could never have again. I mean, it was the kind of unconditional love that is, let's say, the very opposite of the love that Lenny finds with Eunice, who is constantly critical of him. She doesn't like the way he, you know, gives himself pedicures and all this kind of stuff, very petty stuff. But that was the love that's sort of my platonic idea of how family can interact.
So your grandmother, it sounds like she tried to not only express her love, but protect you from the world. By giving you immense amounts of food.
You know, she grew up under Hitler and Stalin, the siege of Leningrad, all this stuff where people were dropping like flies. So to have a fat child is a dream for her, you know, and she was, my father never got very fat. So she was just, and then she would sort of weigh me like a big prized fish. Ooh, 100 kilograms, now we're getting somewhere.
But you probably didn't feel that way about your weight.
I didn't care.
Thing. You didn't?
Oh, no, I didn't care. When you were a Soviet kid in a Hebrew school back then, it was so low on the totem pole. There wasn't even a totem pole. I mean, we were just, remember all those movies back then, Red Dawn, Red Gerbil, Red Hamster, whatever. I mean, it was constantly, my big dream, I remember back then, was just that there would be a nuclear war so I could just start afresh. You know, all of society would be destroyed, Hebrew school would be destroyed, and I can just pick up the pieces and start from the beginning in some nice radiated future.
My guest is novelist Gary Steingart, and his new novel is set in the near future. It's a satirical novel called Super Sad, True Love Story. Eunice, who's the younger girlfriend of the main character, Lenny, let me read a sentence about her. You write, "Unlike others of her generation, she was not completely steeped in pornography. And so the instinct for sex came from somewhere else inside her. It spoke of the need for warmth instead of debasement." I thought that was a really interesting sentence, implying, of course, that you think a lot of young people now are growing up with pornography, probably from DVDs and mostly from the internet, that I would guess you think is really wiring or changing the wiring of their sexual fantasies. So I'm wondering what you've seen or what you're seeing that's leading you to think about how pornography is affecting how people develop sexually now.
We have no idea in the end what it will mean down the line for people who develop in an era where pornography is completely commonplace. I mean, there are sites where you can go online and see naked people and they watch you naked doing things to yourself. And anybody can access that. I mean, there are obviously parental controls, but I think for the most part, kids can find ways to ignore them. I'm not being moralistic here. I'm just saying I have no idea what it will mean down the line when kids grow up with constant access to pornography. I mean, I remember when I was a kid and somebody snuck in a People magazine with Brooke Shields' decolletage showing, and we were just stunned by it. And it fueled our fantasies for so long, but our fantasies were mostly about how much we wanted to just get a nice hug from Ms. Shields. Now kids are not dreaming of hugging Mrs. Shields or who's this famous jail star, Lindsay Lohan or something. The point is, I think, that there's no place, after you've seen the kinds of sexual expressions, there's nothing left to the imagination. It's all there. And then you just have to process it. And I think kids will end up learning how to process it a lot faster. A character like Eunice Park has been completely pornified from the first days of her life. She doesn't blink about it at all. But there's still something lovingly different about her. And that's what Lenny, I think, talks about, how she wants contact more than anything. What draws Lenny and Eunice together is the fact that both of them, they're so different. They're just from different planets. But they both come from deeply dysfunctional immigrant families. And they need a kind of bond that they didn't have in childhood. And they find that bond together, despite the odds, despite everything that stands against them, despite the society that stands against them. In a way, when I think of 1984 and Brave New World, two brilliant dystopian books, I remember some of the ideas better in Brave New World because I think some of the ideas were stronger and more developed than Orwell's sort of Stalinist take on Russia. But I remember 1984 as a novel better because the romance between Julia and Winston was real. It was real, and it was a romance that stood against a society that just wanted to destroy them. And I think, you know, that's why you root for Winston and Julia, because you know that they're doomed.
Just one more thing about that sentence about pornography that I quoted from your novel. You emphasize the word debasement. So is most of the porn that you think is influencing people now about debasement?
I haven't gotten a master's in porn, unfortunately. I don't have the time or the bandwidth. But, you know, but I will say that I think debasement is one of the areas in which it traffics, obviously. You know, it's so interesting because there are now young women get college degrees than men. You would think that the scales really are tipping in favor of women. Men can't seem to go to college and get, you know, as educated as women. There's a huge reversal in that. But there's still on college campuses, there still is this kind of macho, terrible thing that happens. And I think women do feel often very debased. And the pornography certainly reinforces that because it's never, you know, it's never men being hurt, et cetera. It's always the desire is still from a very male perspective.
So in your novel, Lenny's parents are immigrants from Russia and his girlfriend Eunice's parents are immigrants from South Korea, as is your fiancée. She's of South Korean descent, right?
Yes. Yes.
So what are some observations that you've had based on your relationship with your fiancée? Yeah. Based on the fact that you're both from completely different countries and cultures, but you share the bond of being, you know, from immigrant families.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Korean culture is a culture I've been fascinated with ever since I went to Stuyvesant High School, which is, I think, 95% Asian. I think I was the one white guy there. It felt so warm and real to me because it reminded me so much of Soviet Jewish culture in the sense that Korea is a small country surrounded by giants like Japan and China. The relationship is sometimes horrible, sometimes less horrible, but it's a small country surrounded by others. When you're a Soviet Jew, you're a small people, the Jews, surrounded by a larger nation like Russia. You never feel completely completely accepted. So the one thing, though, that you have that's great is this incredible need to succeed through knowledge. Knowledge is so respected by both cultures. It's respected by a lot of cultures, but I think here there's almost a kind of insane emphasis that often has a terrible effect on kids. I mean, I remember just how our parents would say, what, you know, with grades like that, you'll only get into Cornell or University of Pennsylvania. And I still remember my average, 86.894, which is the average that I gave to Lenny. So in my life, I've been so lucky because I've met so many wonderful Korean people. My mentor, Chang-Rae Lee, of course, is a wonderful Korean-American author. And when I was writing this book, I was a little nervous, and I thought, oh, boy, you know, it's always okay to write about your own kind. You can write whatever you want. But, you know, here I am, the Mr. White Guy, writing about Korean culture. So one of the first things I did is, of course, I gave it to him, and I said, is it okay, Chang-Rae? And he said, you write us very lovingly, and that... I took a deep sigh and I thought, all right, no matter what people will say, at least I have my mentor and my friend's approval.
Let me ask you about a scene that you were maybe a little uncomfortable to write. This is a scene at a church with a Korean minister and congregation. It's Reverend Suk's Sinner's Crusade. Why don't you describe this church and what's going on in it?
Well, this was one of these parts of the book that reads to me more like journalism than actual fiction, because a good Korean friend of mine, he and I went to one of these crusades at Madison Square Garden, and so the scene that I describe is fairly accurate. This Korean minister gets on the podium, and there's all these people who look like they just came back from working 800 shifts at their store or somewhere. They look tired. And the last thing they need is for this guy to climb on the podium, and he starts screaming at them for hours on end about how they're not good, they're dirty. And especially the one thing that really struck me was the line, you must throw away of yourself. You must throw away of yourself. You are not good. You are not good enough to stand before Christ yet. So you must throw away of yourself, and then you will be okay to stand before Christ. And, you know, for me, I'm getting all kinds of flashbacks to Hebrew school, to all these different things. Like, you had to say the prayer. The boys were separated, and they had to say the prayer, thank you, God, for not making me a woman. Things like that. Things where religion is shouting at you, telling you have to do this and this and this and this. And you're a tired, impressionable immigrant, and you're just sitting there receiving all these strange waves of negative energy. And yet, I think a lot of people really, you know, I walked out of there shell-shocked, but a lot of people seem to, they almost breathed a sigh of relief, like going to a very damaging deep sauna, and they just said, okay, well, we were beaten with a birch twig for 8 hours, but now we're ready to go back and work the ninth shift at whatever business we have and try to succeed that way, you know. It was a very moving thing because it made me remember what it's like to be at the bottom of a place, not know anything, and you want to reach out for the figures that you think are going to help you, the authority figures, whether it's priests or rabbis or even immediate members of your family. And when they fail you in some way, that hurt is so much deeper because there's nothing else that you can reach out to. You're all alone in this country with them. That's all you have. And that, I think, is the deep pain that Eunice feels and tries to express throughout the book. And that is, I think, why she turns to Lenny. She sees him. He's older. You know, there's certain things he knows. She sees him as a kind of authority figure, somebody who can step in and help her the way nobody helped her when she was growing up. And Lenny, sweet as he is, I don't think is ultimately up to the task.
Now, your character Lenny says at one point in your novel, "Who was I? A secular progressive, perhaps? A liberal, whatever that even means anymore, maybe. But basically, at the end of the busted rainbow, at the end of the day, I'm little more than my parents' son." Do you identify with that?
Yeah, sometimes when I listen to my voice and the intonations and the expressions, and I'm talking in a fairly sophisticated English, and my father's English was never that sophisticated, but sometimes I hear him so clearly. And despite our different political orientations and despite the fact that we really are from different planets, I can feel that strange life force of his inside me, which is a very unnerving, you know. I realize that as far as one can go, and I've come very far, and I've tried to do so many different things in my life, in the end, you really are still them with all the things that you've done to not be them.
And I think, right.
You know what I mean? And Lenny and Eunice are both those people, too. As far as they try to run, in the end, both realize that all they can be is their parents, and added to that, the stuff that they've tried to do to make sure they don't become them.
You know, in our previous interview from 2002, you talked about how you tried out all these different things, Judaism after leaving the Soviet Union, then capitalism when you were in high school at Stuyvesant, then becoming a hippie when you went to college in Oberlin. And you said, after all these manifestations, the real question was, who am I? Who is Gary Steingart? I didn't know. And then you said that the creation of Gary Steingart as a viable persona began when you started seeing an analyst. Mm-hmm. And this might be too personal, but I'm wondering how an analyst helped you integrate the different parts of yourself into a person.
Well, when you come from a country like Russia, you have very different expectations of what makes sense and what doesn't, you know. So what I think my therapist did in some ways, my analyst, I should say, is he simply listened to things and then he wouldn't render a judgment, but he would make me understand that the way I was brought up, it may work in some parts of the world, but that doesn't have to be my destiny. You can be a different person. Certain things will never change, but you don't have to be completely indebted to the past. And you don't have to be a complete facsimile of the past either. That is something very hard for people from very traditional backgrounds. It's like leaving the Orthodox Jewish faith or something. It's very, very difficult to do. So I think being in analysis for this long, and I think I'm almost about to leave, it's time to depart. But it has completely changed my life around because I know who I am. You know, I'm not. It's not entirely a great thing to be me. You know, it's okay. It's not bad, but it's a stable thing now. I wake up in the morning. There's no, you know, I'm not going to snort horse tranquilizer or run naked through the quads of Oberlin or whatever. Those days are behind me. And what I want to do now is just wake up every day, be as productive as I can, try to fight my iPhone fixation. You know. And eat foods that are low in carbohydrates.
I think I've heard you say two contradictory things in the past couple of minutes. One is that what you are is basically your parents' child with the things that you've added onto that in your life. But the other is what you learned from your therapist, that you're not just a product of the past. You can be yourself.
Right. Well, the things that you add on, you know, that's what that's something that therapy allows you to achieve. Those add-ons don't come from free. You know, when I started writing my first book, for example, the Ashkenazi pessimism, the Soviet Ashkenazi pessimism that runs so deep through my veins, did not allow me to even submit my first book for publication. I finished most of it in my senior year at Oberlin. It just sat there and sat there and sat there because, you know, I kept thinking, well, the same kind of thought that my parents or their parents would think, I'm not good. I'm not a good person. This is not a good book. This book won't make anyone happier, richer, anything. This book will simply air our dirty laundry. I can never submit this book. 1 year into therapy, I had a book deal. The book was, you know, the book didn't change. The therapist simply said, well, why don't you submit this book? And not like in a, you know, why aren't you doing it, but simply talk about the reasons you don't want to submit it. And that all happened within the first year of analysis. So yes, you are your own, you are your parents' child, always, always, always. But those add-ons allow you to live a life that is not the life that your parents would have prescribed for you. That's a huge difference. And the hope is that if you reproduce, your children will be even more so than you are. They will have even more leeway to get away from you and their children and their children and their children.
Your work is largely humorous, satirical. Do you think that humor helps distance you from either pessimism or depression that is kind of inbred in you?
Yes. I think it's time to whip out the serotonin selective reuptake inhibitors. Yes, humor is what I have. People say, oh, he's going to write some shticky crap and he's just, you know, he's a humorist, etc. Oh, please. Without humor, I can't go on, and I doubt many of my readers would go on either. Humor is so important. I am here to have fun, too, with my work. I'm here to entertain people. Remember when you used to wake up and think, my God, I got to run to the bookstore because X's book is coming out. I can't wait to read it. It's going to be funny. It's going to be sharp. I can't wait to get my hands on it. And somehow, that kind of literature has begun to escape. I mean, there's a very kind of mass market literature, but a lot of the other kind of literature has become very academic. You know, a lot of it is taught in MFA programs. I teach it one too. A lot of it can be beautifully sculpted, wonderfully written, like a little Fabergé egg, and at the same time miss the vitality, the humor, the feelings of being in love, and the worry about death that often gives rise to the best, the highest order of humor of all, which is probably why Jewish humor is so up at the top of the charts. For me, that would be terrible, you know. And I want fiction to remain a vital force for entertainment. And not just for contemplation. Both things can exist. Why can only madmen tickle our funny bones when so much literature can do just as well?
Now, your new novel, you actually did a satirical trailer for it, as if it were a movie, like a movie trailer. It's online. There's a lot of like really good writers giving you know fake testimonials about the book, and the writers include Edmund White, Jay McInerney, Mary Gateskill, James Franco. He makes an appearance because I think he was one of your students at Columbia.
Yes, he was.
Yeah.
Yes.
So was it your idea to do a trailer, like a funny trailer?
Yeah, I wanted to do a satirical trailer because there's so many heavy-handed sort of terrifying music in the background kind of trailers. I was up at Yaddo, the artist colony, and I was really going through a lot of cabin fever. It was the middle of winter. We were drunk all the time. You know, it's Yaddo. You're drunk. And I woke up after a nap, after drinking too much, and I just thought, you know, and how about a trailer about a writer who never learned how to read? He's completely illiterate. And I thought, oh, I could do it in a Russian accent. You know, I can't read. And I thought, well, who are we going to have for this? Then I thought the testimonials. And so many of my friends are such great actors. They're just, you know, I always think that some of the best writers can, they sort of, when they create dialogue on the page, they kind of say it out loud. And then they're able to just communicate as actors really well. And my thesis proved to be completely correct. Mary Gateskill is hilarious. Edmund White is hilarious. Jay McInerney is beyond hilarious. Jeffrey Eugenides is stunning. And of course, James Franco, who was a student of mine, is a brilliant actor. All I had to do was find a perfect dachshund, a really nice weenie dog to play my pet. And one of my students had a great one. So it just came together and we had a wild time. And, you know, it was, I think it's actually helping the book because whenever people see me, they say, oh, you're that guy who can't read, who wrote a book.
So what do you think the idea of doing a trailer to sell a book?
Well, nowadays, nobody wants to read books. So anything you can do to sell a book, you know, if I could sneak a book into a site of Knish and sell it that way, you know, buy the Knish and then read my book when you finish eating it, that's fine with me too. Whatever it takes to communicate to people that, you know, hey, books still exist, and some of them can be quite humorous. I mean, the trailer had nothing to do with my novel, obviously, but the idea was to sort of get across, hey, Gary Steingart, he's okay, you know, he can make fun of himself, and even though he can't read, he's still a great writer. Because that's another thing that I think the trailer is sort of making fun of, is that everyone is a writer now. You know, everyone's a writer. Nobody wants to read, but everybody wants to write. These MFA programs, we can't, you know, we can't turn them away. There's just millions of applicants. Everybody wants to be a writer. It's this huge culture of self-expression. And there's a magazine called Tin House in Portland that I love, which did this thing where they, you know, in order to, if you're going to submit a story to them, you have to also submit a receipt showing that you bought a book recently. That's the only way they'll look at your story. So I think that's absolutely hilarious. And the other thing about book culture that makes me happy in Seattle, I think the Pacific Northwest is like the last place where books will be read in the world. In Seattle, my friend Christopher Frizzell, who's the editor of The Stranger, a wonderful newspaper there, runs this reading series where nobody reads. I mean, people just sit there reading in this beautiful hotel by a fireplace. They show up, hundreds of people. There's sometimes it's standing room only. And they take out books, and instead of reading out loud, they just read to themselves while this fire crackles and they drink wonderful bourbons and things like that. That was so touching to me, to see a whole community of readers just sitting there, not broadcasting what they're reading. So it wasn't about them, basically. It was about the act of reading, which is trying to commune with the mind of another human being without constantly needing to express yourself, to upload your opinions about something. Look at me, look at me, look at me. And that's what I've been missing, too, I think, in a way, because now as a writer, you're expected to be somebody who does everything that he or she can to connect with people. And some of it is really wonderful, but on the other hand, a lot of it takes you away from what got you interested in doing this and begin with, which is just to sit in a quiet place and try to understand what you are, who you are, and what the world is around you.
Just one more question. Since your novel is so much about how technology is changing people and changing things and shortening attention span and changing communications and changing what we mean by news, do you feel compelled to keep up with everything, or do you feel like you can afford to not keep up without being accused of being out of date yourself? You know, as a writer, you want to kind of connect somehow to the zeitgeist. At the same time, keeping up is so hard. Every day there's so much new news and movies and books and television and information and personal texting. I could go on and on.
Yes, I think it's true. I think when I was writing this book, I obviously had the zeitgeist. I had it, you know, I had a big Z tattooed onto my forehead for zeitgeist because I had to obviously keep track of everything that was happening. And thank God I had a great research assistant. But it was an endless information overload. It made me very, very unhappy because I was so tied in with everything that was going on and I had no personal life of my own. And it really, you know, it began to affect my personal relationships. It began to affect the way I dealt with people. I got run over by 3 cabs because I was so busy getting information out of my iTelephone, just pressing it and hoping something good would come out of it, you know. And it was not, here's the thing about this new technology. I think it's incredibly effective. I just don't think it's made anyone much happier. I think if anything, we are now always connected, but we don't know what we're connected to. You know, it's just an endless stream of information. The next book I'm writing will be a collection of short essays, which will be sort of styled into a memoir. And that will allow me to actually disconnect for a while, I hope for quite a long while, and to sit with, my parents were so sweet, they saved every little scrap of information about my past, every little, you know, when I was a kid, I wrote, in Hebrew school, I wrote a satire of the Torah called the Genora, you know, with chapters like Sexodus instead of Exodus. It still exists. It's still written on a real scroll. And I can go back and look at that and try to understand my past and write about it. And in a sense, I can live an analog life, at least during the time that it takes to write this book. And then, of course, when the book is over, I'm probably going to write another novel that's very much set in the present future. And that will, of course, require me to, you know, by that point, I'm sure there will be a wire connected right directly into my brain, and it will be pumping me with even more information.
Gary Steingart, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's always wonderful.
Gary Steingart's new satirical novel is called Super Sad True Love Story. You can read an excerpt of the book and find a link to the book trailer we talked about on our website, freshair.npr.org. In the movie world, there's a long tradition of movies about the making of movies that take you behind the scenes as a movie is being created. The new documentary Henri Georges Clouzot's Inferno is one of those movies, but with a twist. It chronicles a production that goes disastrously wrong. Our critic at large, John Powers, says that this film about the unmaking of a movie will knock your eyes out.
Early on in Kurt Vonnegut's novel, Helter Skelter, The hero says he thinks it's a shame that young people are raised on inspirational stories of success, because that gives them a misleading idea of life. In fact, he tells us, failure is the norm. Normal or not, there are a few things more irresistibly watchable than a big flamboyant belly flop, especially by someone accustomed to nailing every dive. That's precisely what you get in Henri-Georges Clouzot's Inferno, a fascinating new documentary by Serge Bromberg and Ruxandra Madrea that tells the story of a notoriously catastrophic film project. Its hero is the French filmmaker Henri-Georges Clouzot, best known here for the thrillers Diabolique and The Wages of Fear. In the 40s and 50s, Clouzot was something of a Gallic version of Alfred Hitchcock or Stanley Kubrick, a director who kept making box office hits out of stories that were riveting and dark, even nasty. But when the movies began changing in the early 60s, suddenly new waves were everywhere. He felt challenged and threatened. He had a kind of artistic freakout after seeing Fellini's 8½ and decided he would make a movie that would reinvent the movies. The project was called Inferno, and in it, Clouzot hoped to use all of cinema's resources to take us inside the mind of a middle-aged man, played by Serge Reggiani, who becomes possessed with jealousy over his beautiful young wife. That was Romy Schneider, the delightful, talented, and sexy and Austrian-born star who Hollywood stuck in pictures like What's New, Pussycat? The documentary charts Clouzot's own possession by mad artistic ambition. He turned into a filmmaking Ahab. Blessed, or perhaps cursed, with an unlimited budget, this moody, driven man spent 6 long months obsessively burning money on endless camera tests of the most baroque kinds. He tried different lenses, different lighting, different color schemes, different ways of stretching and fracturing the human face. He tried anything that might make the movie look brand new. Bromberg and Madrea show us these tests, and wow, they range from the totally cool to the authentically breathtaking. Merely smoking a cigarette, Schneider glitters with a glorious avant-garde beauty. And that was just the beginning. Clouzot spent 3 weeks shooting Inferno with a high-priced cast and crew, and we get to see the best footage. It, too, is astonishing. What makes it unforgettable isn't simply the spectacular photography. Water skiing's never looked so wondrous, but the way that the images are charged with passion. I've seen no more visceral image of a husband's fear of his wife's infidelity than Clouzot's shot of Schneider lying nude in the foreground across railway tracks as a train bears down upon her and us. In the end, it was Clouzot who got run over, and unlike Terry Gilliam, whose Don Quixote film fell prey to endless bad luck, he had nobody else to blame. Clouzot hired several brilliant directors of photography, then made them sit around for days as he dawdled over single shots. He did take after take after take, causing Reggiani to quit. And to top it all off, he then had a heart attack, ending the production. Inferno became a legendary, unfinished film, and Clouzot never did anything important again. Now, it's easy to view Henri-Georges Clouzot's Inferno as a cautionary tale about the dangers of artistic overreaching. And there's no doubt that Clouzot did torture himself and others, trying to take the considerable talent he had, and through sheer will, elevate it into the genius he didn't. He simply was not a Griffith or Welles or Godard, transcendent figures who forever changed the way that people thought about movies. Then again, he wasn't a hack. In fact, part of what makes this documentary so memorable is that it offers teasing glimpses of the dreamed-of masterpiece caught in the rubble of Clouzot's obsession. Even in its fragmented and wounded form, his Inferno offers more cinematically thrilling moments than anything currently on our screens. Trust me, you'll remember this failure's images long after you've forgotten countless other movies, even those that have been hailed as a triumph.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. He reviewed Henri-Georges Clouzot's Inferno. A little correction here. When John mentioned Kurt Vonnegut's novel, he said it was called Helter Skelter, but he meant to say Hocus Pocus. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.